Good morning, church. Note to self, have David and Megan go after me next time, not before. It's not a good look. Hey, I wanted to mention something real quick, especially if you're new here. You might not know that we do have training and teaching times other than our gathering here at 10 a.m. We have a 9 a.m. class for adults that meets every Sunday. It has a rotation of teachers, but usually it's our resident Hebrew scholar, Tom Edens. What are y'all studying right now, Tim? Sermon on the Mount. That's right. Studying the Sermon on the Mount right now. Also, I wanted to let you know, in September, I'm going to do a little 5-week training at 9 a.m. on Sunday mornings for anyone who's interested, exploring this theme that Josh sort of introduced a few weeks ago, how we navigate our way through being beloved in the midst of suffering. And I don't know if anybody wants to come to that. So if you want to grab that QR code really quick and message me if you'd like to come, or shoot me an email. We'll put this in an announcement this week so we have it too, dusty@campuschurch.org. Don't ask for money. But if you want to be a part of that, we'll see how many want to be a part of that, and we'll have just a little 5-week discussion about that, all right? Okay, Megan made this observation that love, especially the love of God, is not fragile. And so the question I want to explore this morning is, if love is not fragile, then what is it? What is it if it's not fragile? I want to begin with a problem that we have with love. In the world that we live in, I don't know if this is all over the world, but in the culture that you and I live in right now, it seems like there is a heightened There's a heightened sense that love is often not the proper response to wrongdoing and evil in our world. There's this thing in our culture that we've talked about here before called cancel culture. Have you heard of that? It's rampant in our culture. It's not new. Cancel culture is not new. In fact, it's not political. It's just sort of finds a lot of oxygen and breath in the political world. But religious people have been good at cancel culture for a long time, long before it entered into the political realm. It does seem that in our culture, the presence of the internet and social media and anonymity have really sort of raised the stakes in this human practice of spotting wrongdoing and responding to it with some sort of canceling, shaming, distancing, offering up anger, and even sort of violent words. You've seen this in your world? I gave up Facebook and Instagram a while back because it's just so full of this kind of something in the culture that the people in this church and in many religious contexts have been trying to sort of rid that from the culture of the church, right? Some of you probably grew up in religious contexts that were a kind of cancel culture, a kind of if someone's spotted doing something wrong, and when we say doing something wrong, we meant a particular like 5 or 10 things that fit the bill, then the response is somehow we found religious backing for canceling other human beings. You see this in your world, right? It's alive, and we are sometimes victims of it, and we are sometimes participants in it, and I'm claiming that this kind of something in our culture has really muddied the waters for many Jesus followers, so that love has become fragile in our culture. Maybe it's always been that way, but it seems to be spotlighted right now. Well, I want to make the argument this morning that there's this something else going on that has made it challenging, even for Jesus followers, to abide in a sturdy kind of love in response to friend and enemy, in response to wrongdoing. And it is, in part, the loss of enchantment in our world. We had a conversation this morning with a friend, and we talked about this a little bit, and I started to use enchanted language to talk about spiritual reality. And both of us bristled at the language. We don't use it very much anymore. We're so smart. We've figured everything out. We believe that Jesus rose from the dead, but we're not sure that people were really demon-possessed. We believe that angels ministered to Jesus in the wilderness, but we're not really convinced that there are such a thing as demons that live in our world. We've become, in the West, a disenchanted people. We have, and I say we, I just mean human beings in general, have sort of moved more and more and more toward a modern kind of problem-solving, scientific-oriented, show-me-state kind of prove-it-to-me. And we've lost a little bit of a kind of enchanted, mystical way of thinking about God's presence in the world and what's going on in the world. What's going on in our world? We see humanity and human things going on in our world, and often that's all that we see. And when that's all that we see, my claim is love becomes fragile for us. When the problem is always the other human being, it's difficult for us to imagine a kind of holy, abiding of love, God-centered response to the problem of human beings. Are you with me, church? So Paul writes about this. Paul is the most, before Paul becomes Paul, when Paul is Saul, Paul is the most cancel culture, unenchanted human being in the scriptures. His whole life is this seeing certain human beings as the problem, the Jesus followers, the people who have bought into the lie of enchantment that this Messiah could die and rise again. He says this is his whole outlook on life. And so he responds to human beings by literally, physically canceling the human beings in an attempt to cancel their enchantment, to cancel their, in his mind, ignorant assumptions or beliefs that a human being could rise from the dead. Human beings don't rise from the dead. It's when Paul discovers enchantment, that there's more to life than just the physical, that Jesus has indeed risen from the dead. And Paul claims this thing that in Western world would be hard for many to believe. If I came in this morning and said, on my way to church this morning, God appeared to me in a light and the risen Christ spoke to me, you wouldn't believe me. You know, you would think, what meds is Dusty on now? You know? Paul is the most cancel culture, unenchanted character in the Bible. Paul experiences the rising of Jesus, the enchantment of a world that he thought was just this physically dead something. And it changes the way he thinks about everything, including how he thinks about love and other human beings. So he writes in Ephesians chapter 6. He's urging, in all of his letters, he keeps urging the disciples who are facing all kinds of unthinkable difficulties. He keeps urging them to be strong, to be faithful, Hold on in the midst of your suffering. Hold on in the difficulties, because Christ is risen and Christ is faithful. And he writes, finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his power. My claim, by the way, just says that his power is that he is love. All of this for Paul is anchored in love. We read a couple of weeks ago out of 1 Corinthians that this is the thing that lasts, the love of God. Everything else fades away, but it's the love of God that lasts. Be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his power. Put on the whole armor of God so that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. That's enchanted language, isn't it? For our struggle is not against blood and flesh, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers of this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God so that you may be able to withstand on the evil day, and having prevailed against everything, to stand firm. Do you know how many sermon series I have heard on this passage? And how very little has attended to this sort of enchanted way of viewing the world? That we live in a cosmos that is inhabited with evil and evil beings and a devil, and that they are at work. Every sermon series I've ever heard about this was a week by week, the list of armor that Paul chooses, and it was just sort of swung us way back to physical human beings being physical in the world, and as Megan sort of talked about, doing the things. But Paul's emphasis here, what he adds on about the different parts of the armor, is just this poetic addition to, listen, I saw the risen Christ on the way to Damascus, and the way I saw the world changed that day. And now, he says in 1 Corinthians, the way I see human beings changed that day. I once saw Jesus as just a human being. I see him that way no longer, and I see human beings that way no longer. Listen, church, when you get on Facebook today, when you go to lunch and you have your conversations about all the other human beings in the world, human beings aren't the problem. Human beings aren't evil. Human beings are enslaved by evil often. Human beings are drowning in evil often. Paul claims there is, as you gather this morning, there, I know that this feels cringy for some, there is a cosmic battle going on between love and evil, between God who is love, and his love is not fragile, and demons and devils and evil desires to enslave human beings. Are you with me, church? We don't always think that way, do we? We wrestle with forgiving that person because they hurt us, and all we see is the person, and not this cosmic battle going on to which that person is a victim. We see human beings as opposition, people groups to be conquered. You know, the Christian story is littered with like warring language that was harmful. But that warring language is real and good in the right context, but anytime we sing one of those old hymns that have warring language, I feel a little bit uncomfortable because of the Crusades, because of the conquerors who converted other people groups through warfare, you know? But Paul's warring language is enchanted. It is about this reality that human beings live in a world in which a cosmic war is taking place, in which there are angels and there is a risen Christ and there are demons and devils and slavery to evil in the world. Paul goes on earlier in Ephesians. He writes, getting back to the fragility of power, getting back to where we're headed this morning. Paul writes, he's writing about the Christian's hope in the power of God. In verse 20, he writes, God put this power to work in Christ when he raised him from the dead and seated him at his right hand in the heavenly places, far above all rule and authority and power and dominion, and above every name that is named, not only in this age, but also in the age to come. And he has put all things under his feet and has made him the head over all things for the church, which is his body, the fullness of him who fills all in all. There are lots of different sort of stories and imageries and metaphors for what's happening at the cross in the scriptures. And the most common one in the evangelical world, we've talked about this before, is called penal substitutionary atonement. Say that fast 10 times. And it is this, it was not really the emphasis of how the early church thought about what was happening at the cross. And it has been, there is some language attached to that in the scriptures, but it's, in Dusty's view, really sort of been corrupted in evangelical thought to become this notion that Jesus was punished on the cross by God so that you wouldn't be punished on the cross by God. The scriptures absolutely do not say that. There is this sense of Jesus taking our place. But with the loss of this enchanted understanding of this cosmic war between good and bad, between God and evil, we fail to grasp that it is Jesus taking his place on the cross to face down evil, not to face down God. The more common way of articulating what's happening on the cross for the early church is what we call Christus Victor. It is that Christ is the liberator on the cross. That Christ has gone to the cross, not just to, as we talked about several weeks ago, prove the love of God, prove what was already true about God, but to liberate humanity from, in the midst of this war, from being hostages to evil and evil beings and evil work within the world. Paul writes in Colossians chapter 2, when you were, by the way, if you want to just go back and read through Paul's letters and think Christus Victor, think, okay, I'm gonna stick with Dusty just for a little bit here. I'm going to believe that Dusty, I mean, I don't always have to believe Dusty, and I disagree with him plenty, but I'm just going to stick with him for a little bit, and I'm going to believe that it's not true that Jesus was punished by God so that we wouldn't be punished by God. It's true that Jesus went to the cross to deal with the force of evil so that we wouldn't receive the force of evil. Go back and read Paul's letters with Christus Victor in mind. And see what rises to the surface for you. That Jesus is waging war with evil in the world on our behalf because we have been slaves to evil. In Colossians, he writes, when you were in, this is chapter 2, verse 13, when you were dead in trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh, God made you alive together with him when he forgave us all our trespasses. Erasing the record that stood against us with its legal demands, he set this aside, nailing it to the cross. He disarmed the rulers and authorities and made a public example of them, triumphing over them in it. You see the blending of these two things? That yes, the cross is this moment of forgiveness from God, that Jesus is doing something for humanity. And what is essential in this understanding, in this forgiving work of God, is that Jesus is conquering evil in our world. Are you with me, church? Take a drink. We said drinking game every time I say, are you with me? All right, I want to make these two claims this morning as we think about this notion that love is not fragile, I want to make this claim. Love, when we're talking about the love of God, not just from God, not just the identity of God, but the love of God abiding in us, the love of God intruding into a dark world, that love is the enemy of evil. And love is God's weapon of choice. Love is not only not fragile in that because God is love, love always abides in his children. Love is so not fragile that it is God's weapon of choice. That God is engaged in war with evil. And that unlike the way that unenchanted human beings think about gauging war with evil in the world, God's most powerful act of gauging war with evil is love. Love is a threat to evil in the world. If you doubt me on that, try publicly loving a public enemy. Pick an enemy. Pick someone within a people group who is the poster child for evil in the world and respond to them with the non-fragile, abiding weapon of choice for God, love, and see if you don't get canceled too. There's a reason for that. Love is a threat. Jesus on the cross proves that God loves us. He proves what has always been true about God, and he proves the power of the love that is God. It is not just a weapon. It is the only weapon that will face down the evil in the world in which we live. And so, I know it's a long way to get around to saying, hey, love people. You know? Not just because you're supposed to. Not just because, you know, everybody's messed up and you're messed up and so we ought to love each other. No, far more than that. Because we're engaged in a serious war. And this is our secret weapon. We are a community that is packed full of power because we are the beloved. And as Megan said, God's love is not fragile. It is a weapon. It is a power that changes the world. I've said this before, but I don't love weddings and I love funerals. How weird is that? And I love funerals because funerals often demonstrate the potency and power of love in human beings. When you go to a funeral of someone who has been a child of God, what we're doing is celebrating how the love of God actually made a difference in the world. And that human being didn't know quite how they changed the world. And every time it's this, you know, these are flawed human beings, but the love of God in them changed other human beings because the love of God is not fragile. It is the weapon of choice in this world in which we live. Okay, one last word. 1 Timothy 1. A little bit of a pivot here. Paul's writing to Timothy, this young minister whom he loves and whom he blessed, laid hands on and prayed and commissioned him to be engaged in ministry for the young church. And he writes, he's talking about Timothy's heritage, those women in his life who shaped his faith. And he says, for this reason, I remind you, Timothy, to rekindle the gift of God that is within you through the laying on of my hands. For God did not give us a spirit of cowardice, but rather a spirit of power and love and of self-discipline. I think it's significant that he says these two together, power and love. John will write later that perfect love, this abiding, non-fragile love of God, is the something that casts out fear. Understanding that in an enchanted world makes it different, doesn't it? It's not just, you know, the fear of, am I going to be able to pay the bills, or the sick child? It's the fear of this cosmic war that is taking place, and what is my place within it, and will we survive, and how will we make our way? Love is what abides with the people of God in the midst of that cosmic war. And so I just want to close with this notion that there's something that happens to us when we open our eyes to the enchanted world in which we live, and we respond with this notion that God's love is not fragile, that it is our way in the world. That something that happens to human beings is the removal of fear and anxiety. We live in a world that's just so full of anxiety and fearfulness. And there's a lot going on there. All right. But I do want to say that I want to challenge you that the more you lean into the noun, the beloved, and the more that you receive that as the power within the world, I think that Paul knows what he's talking about and John knows what he's talking about. The less we become fearful, anxious human beings, and all of the canceling and the hating and the unforgiving going on in our world is just fearfulness. It's an anxious posturing within our world. It's a fear of the other instead of an awareness of what is the true evil within our world. Seeing the human being through the eyes of being the beloved. So I want to invite you back into this prayer this week that we talked about early in the series. This prayer, looking at you, looking at me in love. Receiving this in sort of a fresh way this morning, that we are human beings that are participants in, sometimes victims of, witnesses to a cosmic battle between good and evil. And this is our safe zone. This is our shelter. This is our armor. Looking at you, looking at me in love. Believing that when God looks at, believing, first of all, that God is looking at us in love. And believing that he's doing so as his weapon of choice. That this is a liberating love. This is a fighting for you kind of love, a fighting with you kind of love, a rescuing you from the evil, from demons and devils and evil and the movement of evil in our world. Looking at you, looking at me in love. I'm going to invite you to pray that this week. And I want to invite you to just do this little thing to, as often as you can this week, thank God for loving you. It seems like an obvious thing, doesn't it? Like, I mean, the preacher gave us a real hard assignment this week. Thank God for loving me. Do it. Do it. It is his weapon of choice. Lean into it as often as you can articulate it in the midst of your suffering, in the midst of your joy, in the midst of your grouchiness, even in traffic, church. Thank God for loving you with these eyes that are wide open to what might be going on in our world. All right, church, stand with me. Let's before we worship a little bit more, church, let's read this prayer together. Say it with me. Deepen your love in me, O Lord, that I may learn in my inmost heart how sweet it is to love, to be dissolved, and to plunge myself into your love. Let your love possess and raise me above myself with a fervor and wonder beyond imagination. Let me sing the song of love. Let me follow you into the heights. Let my soul spend itself in your praise, rejoicing for love. Let me love you more than myself, and myself only for your sake. Let me love others as your law commands.